This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource of pilots and aircraft owners.
Hello, everyone. This is Paul Bertarelli reporting from the Aircraft Electronics Show at Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm with Dick Rutan, who gave a fascinating talk this morning about his Voyager project in 1986, first unrefueled flight around the world. Dick, you showed your a picture of your panel that you constructed in those days. It would look like an avionics museum. And you're here looking at the new products. If you were doing this project again, building that airplane, could you do it in a much better way? How would it be different?
Well, you need to put things in historical perspective. And, you know, they first flew around the world in 1924 in these old little rickety biplanes and stuff. And then what Lindbergh had when he flew, and there was a lot of avionics advancement between then. But if you take in May of 1927, when Lindbergh flew New York to Paris, it was really a big deal. Put 20 years on that. When you put 20 years on that, you could go to New York and you could buy a ticket, and you could have hot meals and a sleeping berth to go New York to Paris. And when Lindbergh did it, you know, holy bananas, that was really an incredible thing. Now, if you put, well, in this case, 25 years onto what we did, it would be relatively easy. You know, you can be pressurized, you can have high altitude, it can be all, the weather is a lot better, forecasting, it could do it in about 3 days, and it would be a lot simpler. Now, I can have a $1.99 app on my cell phone that gives me GPS, which would be something that would be unheard of back when I was trying to DR with VLF and Omega out over God Lost Your Shoes oceans and trying to use some radar ground mapping to figure out what my coastline is going to be and so forth. And it was considerably different. And the advancement in avionics has been absolutely eye-watering from what they can do. And I think they're just getting started, too.
If you apply the progress in avionics to the creature comforts or lack thereof that you had in that airplane as far as weight and so forth, would you have changed that in the design of it? Would it have been a more comfortable airplane, a faster airplane?
Well, we needed to get around the world, and the range was a big thing. And Bert had the option of doing a pressurized. But and that would require a turbocharger, and it would require a higher altitude, and it would have been a different machine with a lot more items to fail. And I wasn't really keen on the reliability of turbocharging at that time. And so Bert asked me, he says, hey, Dick, if you know, we can do this at low altitude, we don't have to build a pressurized airplane, and it'd only be 5 days longer or 6 days longer, whatever he said. He says, do you mind going that much longer? And I said, heck, I didn't care. Those days I could do anything, I guess, so it really didn't matter. But that decision was a phenomenal decision because it put us down at low altitude and slow and many, many more days. And there's a lot of weather at the equator between ground level and 15,000 feet, like a hell of a lot of weather. And so it put us right down in the middle of that.
When you were showing the picture of the takeoff, I've seen it, we've all seen it probably dozens of times, but it is rather harrowing. When you look at that now, and you said as much in your talk, do you kind of have moments of what was I thinking when I got involved in this project?
Well, yeah, like I talked about in the talk, when I was sitting there ready to roll and thinking back on about how far we come and the risk and the compromises that was made, and the task we had ahead of us. Well, you can only imagine what I was thinking about when I sat there at the end of the runway. And I was fairly confident that there was probably a better than even chance that I would not survive the next 5 minutes. That in the next 5 minutes, I was going to be dead in a horrible crash and a fireball, a conflagration that would be pretty significant with all the fuel we had on board. So my mom always says that the only way to fail is if you quit. And when we were going down the runway and we weren't meeting our acceleration profile checkpoints, we were getting farther and farther behind. At that point, I didn't care. I just wanted the damn thing over with. And when he finally got airborne and we started actually having a good rate of climb and all the engine instruments seemed to settle down, I was really amazed.
Do you think now, 27 years later, that if you or anybody else set out on a project like that, you obviously have better avionics, but do you have better build tools? Would it be a more feasible thing to do? Because that was quite a technical achievement for just a few people to pull off.
Yeah, the thing is that it was possible because of carbon fiber. To do it with aluminum and beating rivets together would have been a joke. It wasn't even close. 900 pounds of aluminum is the same as a Cessna 150. And if you take, 10,000 pounds of fuel and put it on a Cessna 150, it's all you get is a flat smudge mark on the bottom of the ramp thing. So it was just ludicrous. So, every pound of weight that you have for structure, or for G structural margins, and quiet and crash protection and all the other things that most airplanes have, then you're not going to go anyplace. But all those things have to go to the side. You can't have crash survivability. You can't have seat belts. You can't have any redundancies. You can't have any noise suppression. You can't have any crash survivability protection. Nothing. Just absolutely nothing. So, and those are the compromises that you face to do that. Now, maybe you could get away with it once or twice, but in the normal scheme of things, it would be ridiculous to try to be operational with something like that. So you have to have a special set of weather conditions. From Edwards Air Force Base, we had a half a dozen airplanes exploring the air mass between there and out 50 miles at sea. And they all had a sector that they flew in, and they would report back levels of turbulence, if there was any, and where it was. And then based on their reports, we would fly an area to avoid any turbulence, because it had to be absolutely glass smooth. Any kind of turbulence, we'd lost the airplane. So you're in a relatively high state of anxiety the whole time, not being able to see turbulence. Now, you fly around, and if you get moderate or severe or maybe extreme turbulence, and the definitions of those. But what we did, moderate turbulence would destroy the airplane. So we broke up light turbulence into three categories. It was turbulence L1, L2, or L3 turbulence. And L3 was the same as extreme turbulence that on a normal airplane. So turbulence was really a big problem with us.
You were in that airplane for, 7 days. How long did it take you to physically recover from that?
I spent the first three nights in the seat. I never got out of the seat because the co-pilot couldn't fly the airplane when it was heavy. It was 9 days and 3 minutes and 44 seconds, the flight. So, after a day or so in the cockpit, I couldn't even remember that I had a car at home and that people would go out to dinner or they could see a movie or that I had a house or that I had friends. That was so foreign to me that I didn't even, it's like a different universe. It had nothing to do with me. This is my life. This is where I live. And I just had to deal with it. I guess it's similar to the Stockholm syndrome, is that the human beings, they are very adaptable to things like that. And so this is the situation you're in. You deal with it. And my mother says, don't worry about things you can do nothing about. And that bit of advice saved me a whole bunch, because I took off and the winglets are all torn up. And I look out there and I think, there's not a frickin' thing I can do about that. So I just stopped worrying about it. And the only time I worried is when we had to decide what we were going to do. Then we made decisions and executed our plan. But if you can't do anything about it, don't worry about it. It's kind of like I feel when I get in an airliner in the back. I look up and I says, there's not a damn thing I can do about it. If something goes wrong with this airplane, those guys up front will probably screw it up.
But when you got out after that trip, after the 9 days, lasting physical?
I was up all night the night before dealing with a couple of, we lost the engine, and the closest to failure came within the 8 hours before landing. But I landed, and then there was a big press conference, and the damn medical people wanted to push us and probe us for, almost 2.5 hours. And then it went home, the 20 miles home to our home hangar, from the air base back to Mojave. And then we hung around and I talked to everybody for about 6 hours, I think, till 6 o'clock that night. And then I couldn't hold my beer in my hand anymore. It slipped out of my hand. So I went home and slept uninterrupted till noon the next day. And then my whole world had changed after that. Just totally, completely new world.
Well, it was certainly an interesting talk and an interesting story, and I appreciate you talking to us, Dick.
Okay, you bet. Thanks for your interest. It's important.
We've been talking to Dick Rutan, who flew the Voyager around the world in 1986. He spoke here at AEA at Las Vegas. This is Paul Bertarelli reporting. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine. For more information on Aviation Consumer, log on to www.aviationconsumer.com.